From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Spanning the globe to bring you the constant variety of sport, the thrill of victory, and the agony of defeat. The human drama of athletic competition.
The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat, and the human drama of athletic competition. We love sports, and every 4 years we get the pleasure of watching amateur athletes at the top of their game compete in the Olympics. And that got us thinking about competition, because that's what it's about, right? So we put together our favorite interviews with athletes about competition. First up is swimmer Lynn Cox. She's a competitor on a whole different level. Calling Lynn Cox a swimmer is like calling Muhammad Ali a tough guy. At age 14, she swam to Catalina Island from mainland California. At 18, she swam between the islands of New Zealand. She broke the men's and women's records for the English Channel and crossed the Strait of Magellan. And then she turned her eye to the unthinkable, the icy waters of Antarctica. She wrote about that adventure in her book, Swimming to Antarctica. She tells Steve Paulson how she trained and how she's able to survive in such icy waters without a wetsuit.
The currents and tides aren't mapped. They've been studying them down there for 17 years, and people still don't know which way the currents move. And usually when you do a channel swim, that's one of the basic things that you figure out ahead of time. Also, the weather there is so unstable. It can go from a very calm to 60-knot winds within 15 or 20 minutes. There's also the problem of ice. You can have glaciers snap off and become icebergs, and if you're swimming around them, it can be a bad thing. So those were some of the challenges, but also beyond that, there was the wildlife. There were orcas, killer whales, and there were also leopard seals that are 10 feet long and weigh up to 1,000 pounds, and they can be aggressive. And actually, a British researcher was killed by one about 3 months after I was down there.
So you like this kind of danger, is what you're telling me.
I like this kind of exploration. I like the idea of pushing the body beyond what's been done and sort of feeling out what human beings can do and how far that reach can be. Also, the other idea is that you're sort of jumping into this unexplored territory where people haven't been before in a bathing suit cap and goggles. And just the sensation of it is so extraordinary to be in water that's 32 degrees and realize that it feels so viscous because it is so thick, because it is so dense. And it's just weird to have that kind of experience. But more than that, the water there is so clear, you can see as if it's like moving through sky.
Hmm. Now, to think you were going to swim in this water, were you scared?
There was a big element of fear in this whole thing because I knew that no one had done this before, and I trained for it, and I had done swims that were in water as cold as 38 degrees, but nothing like this before. So it was a huge challenge.
Now, you had actually been training for this particular swim in the Antarctic for 2 years. What did you do to get ready for this extremely cold water?
I did things I'd never done before. I sort of became a sprinter. Instead of training and going 4 or 5 hour swims, I wound up doing an hour in my folks' backyard pool, swimming head up and moving arms as fast as I could for an hour, and basically trying to simulate what I would be doing something similar to in Antarctica. The biggest thing I really needed to do was to learn how to swim more with my head up and at the same time have the power to move through the water.
Now, the reason for swimming with the head up is it's just too cold. You lose too much body heat if you have your head in the water?
That's exactly right. You lose up to 80% of your heat through your head. You know that, being in Wisconsin. And so the idea was that if I could swim head up, I would be able to prolong my ability to stay in the cold. But at some point, you know, you get tireder because you're pressing your entire body against the water. You're sort of almost swimming it upright. So in order to compensate for that, I had to do a whole lot more weight training. And I actually worked with a trainer who had been a collegiate wrestler who helped me work on building upper body strength.
Did you also just spend time in the cold, whether it's cold water or cold air, just kind of hanging out to try to get used to it?
Yes, I went to Ushuaia, Argentina, at the very tip of Argentina, and trained in the harbor there, where the water temperature was about 40 degrees. And actually, it was so cold that it would take me pretty much all day to psych up to go in for my workout. And then I'd sort of put my clothes down on the beach, and hopefully they wouldn't blow into the water. There's some days the winds were between 40 and 50 knots, and it was just hard getting in. And yet, I knew I had to do this to prepare for the swim in Antarctica.
Now, we've been talking about some of the preparation you did to get ready for this swim in the Antarctic. One thing was to try to figure out what you'd do after you got out of the water, because there was a real danger of hypothermia, and these temperatures could kill an ordinary person in not very many minutes.
Yeah, actually, I found out from a professor at the University of Edmonton that the normal response to falling into water that's below 40 degrees is that you'll start to seize up after 6 or 8 minutes. You won't be able to have the muscular impulses, the neuromuscular impulses, to make the muscles move. And so he thought this was just astonishing that I could even swim in that water. But the biggest concern I had really was for afterwards, because when you're no longer creating heat through muscle activity, you start to get cold, and then you start to bring in the cool blood from the exterior body and put it into your core of your body, and you get what's called afterdrop. And so your temperature starts to plummet, and that's when you can have really big problems where your heart can go into arrhythmia or something worse. So what we did instead was to get a scarf and a polypropylene shirt and some pants. And a friend of mine sewed pockets into them. So the pockets were on either side of my neck, under my armpits, and right near the hip bones. And we put hot packs in those areas, those things that you use when you go skiing and you get cold and you want to warm up your fingers or your toes. That's what we did. So when I finished the swim, I put those clothes on, but I also had my doctor friends who basically acted like penguins and moved in really, really close to me and hugged me and gave me their body heat. And I sort of shivered for an hour and got my temperature back up to normal.
Hmm. Now, it's worth pointing out that you are a medical marvel. For some reason, temperatures that would kill a lot of other people don't for you. And scientists have actually tested your body, your physiology. What have they discovered about you?
They've discovered that I am able to close down the circulation to the peripheral area, to the skin and to the fingers and toes and hands and feet really rapidly and keep it closed down. If you took an untrained person and put them in the cold, you'd have that response initially. And then at some point, the body would say, you know, we need to get oxygen out to those tissues. And so they would send, the body would start sending surges of blood out there and then bring that cooled blood back to the core. And that in turn would cool down the core, the center of the body. But my body basically says, lose the hands, lose the feet, keep the core warm and keep the brain and lungs and heart going. And it also will sort of send out a minute amount of blood to the extremities at the fingertip level and at the toe level.
Okay, so you had your practice swim. You realized you could do that. And now it was time for the real one, for the whole 1 mile touching land on Antarctica. What happened?
Well, we took the ship down to an area called Paradise Harbor. And we were looking for beaches where I could land. There aren't that many beaches in Antarctica along the peninsula. There are areas that are huge glaciers that just sort of slide right down to the ocean. And you can't swim near those glaciers because you're afraid of the falling icebergs. So we kept looking for places where we could land, but there weren't many because the wind had shifted and the icebergs had sort of accumulated in different areas, and a lot of them were the beaches. So we searched for probably half the morning until we came to a place called Niuko Harbor. And it's this just beautiful area where the beach is maybe an 800-yard wide strip that's sort of terracotta stoned, and there are glaciers on either side of it. And we saw that the weather was fairly calm and decided that it was a good day for a swim.
So you just hopped in the water and did your mile.
That's pretty much it. I mean, there's really no time to sort of quibble or second guess or wonder. The crew had been through the test swim. They knew what they needed to do. And so I went into the cabin to sort of sit down and focus. And actually, I got some temperature measurements before and after the swim. And so we found that taking the core temperature before I even started the swim, my temperature was up to 102.2. And then when I finished the swim, it was down to 90. 5:05. And within an hour, it was back up to normal.
Hmm. How difficult was that swim?
Really, 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 really hard. It was the most difficult thing I've ever done, mostly because I had done the test swim only a day before, and it took a huge amount out of me. And also, I had had some nerve damage from that first swim, so I realized that my first line of defense of being able to tell how I was doing on the peripheral area, you know, on the skin level, was gone. And so that would mean that I'd have to even be more fine-tuned to what was going on and more aware of what was going on around me. But it was also hard because I really didn't like shivering so hard at the end of the first test swim. Your body has to work awfully hard when it's that cold to get warm again. And I think I was working as hard shivering as I had done during that first test swim. And I actually thought, you know what? I swam 9/10 of a mile. Maybe that should count as the Antarctic mile. This is all true. It's like, oh, no. And then I thought, you know, I've come this far. And this would be short as a goal, and I really should go for the mile. And I really wanted to swim to the continent, you know, not the subcontinent. And this was 32-degree water, and it was just that degree more. And so I think I just decided that it was time to do it when the conditions are right, and we went forward.
Now, it sounds just miserable. I mean, it's basically a survival test. Can you do it? Is there anything at all enjoyable about this?
It's not miserable, and it's not a survival test. I mean, those are elements in it, but it's also the idea that you are jumping into unknown waters, that you are swimming through water that is so clear that you can see penguins jumping in toward the end of the swim and swimming with you. You can see them porpoising through the water and see their water bubbles coming up all around you. And you are sort of in a world that nobody else has really been in this way before, or maybe even wanted to ever do it that way.
So what did it feel like at the end when you touched land? Did you have this great sense of triumph?
I had this great sense of triumph because it was as if we had done something never done, and I had a group of people around me who had shared in this idea and this dream and had extended themselves to help me do what I wanted to do, and I felt like it was an achievement that we really all shared.
Now, you've said this was your hardest swim that you've ever done, but you've done some pretty hard swims in earlier years. I mean, there was one, for instance, down in New Zealand where you, after, what, a few hours, you actually were further back from where you had started from because the waves were so big?
Actually, that's exactly right. I had been swimming between the North and South Islands of New Zealand. And there were two storms converging, and we weren't aware of it because we didn't have the weather satellite stuff that we have now. And so after 5 hours of swimming, I was further from the finish than I had started. The current had carried me around the North Island, and I was really fighting to go on.
But you did go on.
Well, I did go on because I had a school of dolphins who came in and started swimming with me, with the people in the boats. They were all around our boats and beside the paddler near me. The water visibility was about 50 feet, and you could look down and see dolphins swimming around dolphins, and they would suddenly leap out of the water and then spin and spiral and click and squeak and chatter. And they stayed with me for about an hour. And in that time, I sort of lost the sense of I can't do this anymore. So I kept going. And periodically throughout the next, I don't know how many hours, the swim wound up taking 12 hours and 2 minutes. But throughout the swim, the dolphins would come back in moments when I didn't feel like I could go any further. And actually, toward the end of the swim, they wound up guiding us right into an area where I could land on shore.
Hmm. And the story then of what happened throughout New Zealand, I mean, it sounds like it almost turned into a national celebration that you had done this swim.
Actually, while I was swimming and having so many difficulties, people throughout New Zealand began calling out to the ship's radio to say, you know, Lynn, we believe in you. Keep going. There were Boy Scouts from Christchurch and beekeepers from Wellington and people all over the country, even as far as the Bay of Islands to the north, were calling and saying, keep going. And actually, the Prime Minister of New Zealand called and said, you have the country of New Zealand behind you. So it was really extraordinary. And actually, during the swim, there were a couple ships that went across Cook Straits, and they came in and raised the American flag and tooted their horns and basically showed their support. So by the time I finished the swim, pretty much all the country, you know, the land of Hillary, knew about my swim. And then the next day, church bells were rung throughout the country at noon.
I can't imagine that.
It was wonderful. It made me realize that a swim can be so much more than just an athletic venture, that it can be a way to bring people together. And through that, you know, you get so much strength, but also they share in that excitement of being able to succeed at it.
Lynn Cox's book is called Swimming to Antarctica. Steve Paulson talked with her. I'm Jim Fleming. You're listening to the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. To the Best of Our Knowledge is hard at work on a series on consciousness called Meet Your Mind, a user's guide to the science of consciousness. We're also trying something totally outside our expertise, publishing a comic book on the same subject. Watch our video at ttbook.org to see how we plan to pull it off. This hour, in light of the Olympics, we're talking about competition and sports. Up next, birdwatching. I know, bird watching as a competitive sport, but it's serious, says Mark Obmashek. He's the author of The Big Year, A Tale of Man, Nature, and Fowl Obsession. He tells N. Strange Champs about the biggest competition in North America.
Well, here's the math of a big year. There are roughly 675 native species in North America. Now, these are birds that either live here, nest here, or migrate through on the grand sweeping pendulum that happens twice a year, spring migration, fall migration. 675 birds. Well, the winner of this contest saw 745 birds, which is just unparalleled. In fact, they say it's a record that probably will never be broken. In fact, in this year, the year that I wrote about, 1998, the strongest El Nino on record, all three of these contestants each saw more than 700 birds in their big year. It used to be considered an amazing feat in birding to see 600 species in a lifetime. These guys saw more than 700 in a year. It's really a staggering accomplishment.
I was trying to think about that, about how you'd go about doing it. One thing I thought was, these must be people who have entire field guides memorized so that just to be able to recognize that many birds is astonishing.
These guys are two-legged libraries. It's an amazingly intimidating thing to go in the field with them because, I mean, these guys kind of sucked me in. I went native on this story. I started out more interested in writing about obsession than the objects of their obsession. But just to be with these guys in the field, they're like grown-up Tom Sawyers. They've got this terrific zest, this great enthusiasm for life. And I would be with them, and I would try to tag along and identify some of these species on my own. So I would, you know, faithfully be carrying my Sibley guide, 545 pages of pictures and descriptions of the native birds of North America. And these guys, they don't even bother. I mean, sometimes they don't even bring it with them in the car. They just know everything. And in fact, one of the guys is even better he's beyond amazing on the wing. He does it by ear. The first time I went in the field with him, Greg Miller, I thought he was playing a David Letterman trick on me. We got out of the car near some woods, and he just started calling out, Sedge Wren, Marsh Wren, Northern Cardinal, Lazuli Bunting. He hadn't even picked up his binoculars. He had learned to bird by ear. He can recognize the bird call of pretty much more than 600 native species to North America. I mean, some people like me, I can probably identify most Rolling Stone songs by the first three chords. Well, Greg knows the chip notes of more than 600 species in North America. It's phenomenal.
There's a story you tell. I think this must be the same guy. He went out. I think he was someplace where he was looking for warblers, and what, he could distinguish the one song out of 35 different warblers. But how different can a warbler sound from another warbler? But he could find the one out of 35 that he didn't have in his list yet just from the song.
Go figure. There's an amazing bird called the Kirtland's warbler, which is smart enough to spend most of its life in the Bahamas. But then for some reason, you know, hormones take over or you know, whatever. Birds do it. Bees do it. They decide to fly all the way to Northern Michigan, just to have sex in this one particular stand of trees, second growth jack pine forest. Well, Greg went with his father, who was the guy who taught him how to bird, and they went looking for a Kirtland's warbler, one of the rarest species on the face of the earth. Now, the woods in northern Michigan in summer are just brimming with life. I mean, there's warblers, there's cardinals, there's buntings, I mean, and there's mammals. I mean, it's just brimming with this amazing symphony of life. And the way that they found this one bird was it was the only sound in the forest that they didn't recognize.
Wow, that's an amazing story. Tell me about the other contestants that you were tracking.
Well, the other two guys, the first guy is really the guy who sold me on the story, a guy named Sandy Comito, who has a voice that starts about three floors below the basement. He grew up in the Bronx and definitely has a Bronx accent and grew up really poor, so poor that, in fact, he had only one shirt as a boy that he used to have to wash himself before he went to school in the morning. But Sandy managed to scrap and claw his way to the top of one of the toughest, most macho businesses anywhere. He's a New Jersey industrial contractor. But he still had this irrepressible itch to bird. I mean, I think that birds for him were kind of his ticket out of the concrete of the Bronx. Now, Sandy was the defending big year champion. He had set the record in 1987 and then sat back for a decade and watched many other birders, including some of his best friends, take whacks at his record, you know, do these full-out frontal assaults, spending $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a month traveling tens of thousands of miles to get these birds. And Sandy, like many of these competitive birders, is such a perfectionist. He knew that he could have done better. In 1987, there were some species that he just flat out missed. And there were others that he thought that if he organized things a little bit better, I mean, the logistics of a big year are pretty staggering, but he just thought if he organized things a little bit better, he might be able to improve his number. And finally, I think his wife just got a little tired of him, seeing him pace around the house a lot, saying, get out of here, go do a big year. It's driving you nuts, go try it. So that's one contestant, Sandy Comito.
I see what you mean about obsessed. So what did they have to do? It wasn't obviously going to be enough to just go out and find some places where there were lots of birds and start looking for them. To achieve at this level and rack up this many species, they had to get really, really specific about specific birds, right?
One of the really cool things about birds is just how persnickety they are about where they live. It's not like you can just set up in one part of the country and expect to see all 675 native species to North America. No, I mean, there are birds that, for some reason, they look nearly identical, but there are some sandpipers that insist on seeing the sun set every night on the Pacific Ocean, and then there are others that insist on only seeing the sun rise in the morning over the Atlantic Ocean. You've got to see both of them in the course of a big year to build your big list. And so it's a little like the circus act of spinning those plates up on sticks and trying to keep one from falling. What these guys would do is scramble madly from bird to bird. Now, one of the wild things about what's happened lately is with the information revolution, there are a lot of places in North America where a rare bird can't really land and be there by itself. It ends up on a web page, a rare bird alert, within an hour or 2 hours.
A rare bird alert?
North American rare bird
out?
Alert. Well, there are places where birders concentrate. And when a bird lands in a place like High Island, Texas, for example, or Point Pelee, Ontario, Cape May, New Jersey, around Monterey Bay, California, I mean, these are some of the big stations of the cross for birders because they're kind of migrant traps. You know, birds that are coming from the south up to the north to breed tend to rest there, or maybe storms knock them down there. Well, there's always birders waiting for these birds there. And as soon as a good one or a weird one shows up, they put it out on the web. There was even one service out of Houston called the North American Rare Bird Alert run by a guy who used to be a doctor in Canada but actually moved down to southern Texas because the birding was better there. He charged a fee, I think a $25 membership fee, and then for an additional price, I think of $25, he would literally call you in the middle of the night and say, there's a whiskered tern being seen in Cape May, New Jersey. Get on the next flight. Get out there for the red eye.
So what these guys happens, would go. What happens when a rare bird alert goes out?
Well, when a rare bird alert goes out, all chaos breaks out because there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people in this country who will chase rare birds. In fact, at one point during the big year, there was this little tiny bird, about as big as your pinky, called a Xanthus's hummingbird, a brilliant green iridescent creature, so light that I think you could mail 10 of these birds for the price of a single first-class postage stamp. Hmm. Well, what happened with the Xanthus's hummingbird was there was a freak hurricane that hit its native home of Cabo San Lucas, Mexico, and it blew that bird, for some reason, all the way up to Gibson's, British Columbia, near Vancouver, which, for some reason, this bird decided to spend the winter there. Well, the word went out on the rare bird alerts, and there were so many birders who came to see this bird that the homeowner, the poor homeowner who had the feeder, the sugar water feeder, started to get overwhelmed. Because naturally, this being the Pacific Northwest in the winter, the main way to get to Gibson's, British Columbia, was to ride the ferry from Vancouver. Well, of course, the first thing everybody would do, first thing in the morning on the ferry, is they would coffee up. So they'd, you know, have their one or two cups of coffee and then get off that ferry and then trundle up to the Patterson's driveway and wait for this little tiny creature to come up. And sure enough, you know, you can't buy coffee. You can only rent it. So the poor Pattersons would look out their window, and these people are doing the little wiggly jig out there. So finally, everybody took a collection, and they went in. They got a porta potty and put it in the driveway. I think before that bird left that winter, there were more than, I think, 3,000 people who signed the log. They came to see that bird. 3,000 people to see one teeny creature.
Oh, my word. Yeah, I had the image of these lone champion birders off scaling mountain cliffs all by themselves or hacking their way through North American jungles just for the sight of one bird, but it sounds like it was more like a big road show.
Well, sometimes it was. I mean, these guys were definitely alone in the Everglades at dawn. You know, they were in the north woods of Minnesota after dusk looking for owls. They were in the Chiricahua Mountains of far southeastern Arizona, one of the last holdouts or hangouts of a Geronimo, you know, looking for trogons. But they also, I mean, it's a bird's eye view of the continent, so you've got to chase these species where they go.
Did you wonder, I mean, as you spent time with these guys and began to go out birding yourself, you must have wondered what the appeal was of this. I mean, it's one thing to like birds and maybe want to have kind of an interesting life list, but why do people like this become this obsessed?
Boy, you know, I asked these guys that question probably a million different ways, and finally they just got sick of me asking it. One guy cut me off and just said, you know, why'd you fall in love with your wife? And I just came to conclude that obsession, passion, it's just something you can't put into words. It's something you feel, and it's just something that drives you. I don't know that these guys can explain it in a way that I can understand, or maybe in a way that anyone can understand. It's just something that they love to do. But what I could understand is, what if you had a year of your life to do anything you wanted and had unlimited time? In a couple of cases like these guys, unlimited funds, what would you do? What would you do for a year? I mean, these guys had this dream of seeing all the birds of North America in a year. And it was not only to see the birds, but also it was beat the clock. I mean, they were always up against the calendar. And it was beat each other, too. They had to get them before these other two guys. And for them, frankly, it was thrilling and exciting. It was a magnificent travel log. And if you look at the result, I think that it cost them dearly. I mean, it cost them financially a lot of money. It cost them, in some cases, it cost them their health. A couple of these guys got sick during the year and never really recovered. They were just driving themselves so hard. I mean, think of that. 270 days, waking up at 4 in the morning every day. I mean, it's amazing. But if you talk to them, they have no regrets. They lived their dream. They did exactly what they wanted to do. And, you know, I think that's a pretty universal thing.
Marco Meshek's the author of The Big Year, a tale of man, nature, and foul obsession. He spoke with Anne Strangchamps. It's been called the Gravity Grand Prix and the greatest amateur race in the world. But to the million-plus kids who've been a part of it, it's just the Soapbox Derby. The Soapbox Derby started back in 1933, and since then, over a million kids have participated. One of my favorite sports interviews of the last 20 years was in 2005 with 15-year-old Tyler Gallagher, right after he won All-American Soapbox Derby's Super Stock World Championship. I also spoke with an equally excited Jeff Faiula, the Derby's general manager. Here's Tyler.
I was just glad to even get to the final race, you know, because the year before that I got knocked out the first round, so I just wanted to get fast a couple rounds, and from there on, you know, we were hoping the best, you know, but we weren't expecting to win, I can tell you that right now.
How fast did you have to go to win?
Oh, we're around 35 miles an hour going down the hill.
Wow. Tell me about your car. Can you describe it for me?
I run a super stock car, and it had a scenery of, like, castles and background of rocks, pointy rocks. There's a couple castles, a couple bridges, and I had a dragon on the front and a dragon on the back. Wow. The one on the front was red and the one on the back was green.
Jeff, you're the Soapbox Derby general manager, right?
Correct, yep.
Tell me how this thing got started.
The Soapbox Derby actually got started in Dayton, Ohio. It wasn't even in Akron, but back in 1933, a man named Myron Scotty was a photographer for the Dayton Daily News, and he saw these five kids going down the hill in these little homemade cars, and he thought, man, that's a great idea. So he went and convinced his publisher to give him a couple $100, and he ran a citywide race that summer, had over 260 kids in the race. And by the way, they thought it was all boys until they were giving out the prizes, and the second prize was a boys' bicycle. And this little girl named Alice Johnson took off her hat and received the boy's bike. And that year, there was actually three girls in that race. But it was the last time girls raced again until 1971. But the next year, he convinced Chevrolet to run a national race. And in 34, we had our first All-American.
Wow.
And that was also in Dayton. And then they moved it to Akron in 35, and it's been there ever since.
Is this, you know, real straight elimination? Every kid makes their own car? I mean, what kind of rules are there to how you get into the race?
There's a lot of rules today because we want to make sure that everybody's just as equal as possible. And, of course, we have all little specifics. We want to make sure that it's not too long, that it's not too heavy, that it's not the steering's just right, that the brake works okay, because safety's a lot of it, too. And, you know, these kids, like Tyler said, are going down the hill 30 to 35 miles an hour, and they're only 8 to 17 years old. So, you know, you want to be sure everything's very safe. And rules are for really two reasons. One is to gain an unfair advantage, and the other is safety. So we make sure that one of those two, it fits in there with all the rules.
Yeah, I was thinking about that 35 miles an hour, Tyler, and thinking, you know, it doesn't sound all that fast in these days of NASCAR and all of the racers. But when you're down, what, 6-8 inches off the ground going 35 miles an hour down a hill?
3 inches.
Three inches? 3 inches off the ground. Boy, 35 miles an hour must seem really, really fast.
Sometimes it's almost scary to think about it. So you pretty much just try not to think about it when you're going down the hill and focus on the race.
When did you get into this? When did you start racing?
About 5 years ago, in 2002. My sister raced in 2002. She went to the All-American in a super stock, and she placed fourth in the world. That's how I kind of got started and getting more involved and more involved in it, and there I am today. So. Yeah.
So you knew something about the history of the race when you started in it?
Kind of not really. My dad always wanted to do it. He just never had the time nor the quite not enough money to do it. But we saw a little ad in the paper, and it said a little clinic that was going on in Akron. And we stopped by and checked it out, and we got interested in there and went on from that.
Wow. Tyler, you said your dad really wanted to do it and never could. Has he been involved with you in making this car?
Oh, most definitely. He's probably put more time and effort than all of us put together in the whole family. He spends countless nights down at the shop. I mean, school nights, we usually go to bed around 9:30, but he's down there until 11 o'clock, almost 12 o'clock at night, just trying to work on these cars, trying to fine-tune them for the races.
You see yourself 15 years from now down in the basement working on a Soapbox Derby car, helping some other kid win?
Yeah, probably. Maybe my children. I'd get them involved in a Soapbox Derby. You know, I kind of cherish the moment and maybe want them to have the same thing. So, yeah, maybe in the future I might get my kids involved or something like that.
Jeff, there's so many things to take the time of kids these days, computers and video games and all of that. But Soapbox Derby, you see as being around forever?
Well, we sure hope so. You know, I mean, this is the 69th running that we're having this week at Derby Downs, and that's pretty good. You know, the only two car races longer than us are, of course, Pikes Peak out in Colorado and that big race they run over in Indianapolis. But so, you know, that's not bad to be the third longest racing event, but we've changed things to try to adapt to the kids of the 21st century here, you know. One of the things that I say is that they don't have the three T's. They don't have nearly the time, the talent, or the tools today that they had back in the, let's say, the 60s or the 70s. So we've made it a lot easier. It only takes 4 to 6 hours to build a car. That's the time element. They don't have nearly the tools that their dads had or whatever, but it doesn't take many tools. Ask Tyler, it only took 4 or 5, you know, tools. Maybe electric screwdriver is about the only really electric tool that he needs. And then they don't really have quite the talent that they had in the previous generation, but it doesn't take as much talent. It takes more talent in the driving. That's why Tyler won the race. His car was similar to everybody else's, but he outdrove them all. And that's how he won his $5,000 scholarship. So it doesn't matter who's helping him. It's who's driving the car.
So, Tyler, you've been driving this car, and Jeff just said that it's your driving ability that won that race for you. Do you figure you can carry that over to getting your driver's license?
Actually, ever since I've been 6, I've been driving actually real cars at my dad's work and stuff. We're self-employed. We own a mulch business, and I drive the trucks around the yard and stuff. And about 3 years ago, I started driving semis then. I drive them around the yard. So, yeah, it'll carry over a little bit, but...
You're fairly confident you're going to pass that driver's license the first time.
I think so. My mom wasn't too sure that I was going to pass my temporary permit driver's license, but I showed her, you know.
Tyler Gallagher won the All-American Soapbox Derby's Super Stock World Championship back in 2005. Jeff Iula is the Derby's general manager. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about athletic competition. Andre Agassi knows a thing or two about that. He's one of the greatest tennis players of all time. But the thing is, he hates competition and tennis. Steve Paulson spoke with Agassi right after his retirement in 2006. Steve started with the first page of Agassi's memoir, Open.
On the very first page of your book, you say you hate tennis. You hate it with a dark and secret passion. And throughout the book, you keep saying this to the people who become important in your life. And of course, no one believes you at first when you tell them that you hate tennis. So I guess I have to ask, do you still hate tennis now that you're retired?
No, I do not hate tennis. You know, people say, is it a love-hate relationship? I said, it's more like a hate-love relationship. You know, tennis was something I certainly didn't choose. I didn't choose as a young man. My father kind of pushed it on me. I felt fear to not do it, not in any sort of form of abuse, but in the form of just having the pressure of the world on my shoulders. He introduced me as the future number one player in the world. And then I went to an academy that I hated. It was more like a glorified prison camp, and then my only way out of there was to succeed. So then I succeeded and found myself on a world stage that scared the living daylights out of me, and all of a sudden I'm being judged for many things that I was and wasn't. So I never had ownership of tennis. I was scared later on, and I played because I was just didn't know what else I was going to do. And it wasn't probably till I was 27 years old that I took ownership of my choices and chose the very thing that I hadn't chosen my whole life. And when that happened, the scale started to get balanced. I started to understand what it was giving me, my school in Las Vegas that I built. It gave me my wife. And it made a lot more sense to me then.
Let me take you back to the early days that you write about with your father and how intense that was. I mean, you talk about how he groomed you to become the best player in the world, and he taught you some things that made you a great player, like learning to take the ball on the rise when you were 7 years old. How did he do that?
Well, he did that by inventing one of the gnarliest looking ball machines you've ever seen, and I nicknamed it the Dragon in the book because it stood in front of me fire breathing, you know, and he pushed that thing as close to the net as possible, and it had this long aluminum tube necking, and the thing would hold this ball in its throat until the pressure built up so much, and then it would fire out at about 110 miles an hour. And then he would kind of pace behind me back and forth, you know, a bit like a caged lion, kind of making sure I'm staying on the baseline and don't back up, don't let the ball play you, you play the ball, go after it, hit it harder, hit it harder, hit it earlier, you know. And so you learn fundamentals that allow you to deal with those sort of extremes. And as a result, you have the skill set to kind of adjust to the pace of tennis picking up as you get older, and was probably a huge reason for my success in between the lines.
Hmm. So why do you think your father was so determined to turn you into a great player?
For him, you know, he's from what he calls the old country, and he didn't have a life of choice himself. And he, you know, grew up fighting the world, you know, getting a lot of fights as a kid because of being a Christian Armenian and a Muslim Tehran, getting in a lot of fights because his mother would make him wear hand-me-down girls' clothing as punishment. She was pretty abrasive, pretty abusive in many ways. And so he fought, and then he went into boxing because he realized he was good at it. And as a result, I think he's been fighting his whole life. It's just, you know, the world's against him, and he saw tennis as the quickest road to the American dream and wanted that for his kids. And he brought his intensities and his rage. I mean, anger was a way that he kind of reacted to a lot of things. If he didn't understand his own emotions, he would get upset. And I think that tennis reminded him of boxing without the downside of physical contact.
So were you afraid of your father when you were growing up?
I think you're afraid of any father at 7 years old when you're looking up at this man and you watch him knock somebody out in the middle of a street. You know, I wasn't afraid that he didn't love me. I wish his love was softer. I wish it was just a little less. You know, the intensity of his loyalties were unmistakable. The intensity of how much pride he took in me just has a real healthy power over a young man growing up, but there's a real level of fear as it relates to, you know, watching your dad fight, seeing him get in fights. Also, too, just the mood of the house. If you weren't winning or you weren't practicing well or hard enough or long enough, I mean, it fundamentally unsettled him. And when he was unsettled, everybody around him was unsettled.
Now, you were a Vegas kid, and once you started getting good, you hustled people for money as well. And you have a great story of Jim Brown, the old NFL great who shows up in Vegas and comes to your tennis club and is looking to play for money. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, it was at my racket club. We go walking into Cambridge Racket Club like we did on most days, and my dad points out Jim Brown and says, "You see who that man is? That's Jim Brown, one of the greatest football players of all time." And I was like, "Whoa, okay." And I'm looking at him, this big man, and he's talking to the manager of the club, who we knew pretty well, and he's upset that a money match fell through. The guy didn't show up, and he wanted somebody to play. He loved gambling. He loved tennis. And my dad steps in and says, "My son will play you." And he says, "If you're looking for a game." And he turns around and says, he kind of snickers and basically says, "You know, I'm looking to play for money." And I says, "Well, he'll play you for your whatever you want." And he says, "You know, I'm talking about real money." He says, "He'll play you for your effing house." And Jim Brown says, "I don't need your house. I got a house. What do you say we play for 10 grand? And says, "Let's go." And I mean, I'm starting to sweat. I'm just standing there, my eyes like saucers, like poker chips, you know. And Jim Brown says, "Not so fast. You need to go home and show me some money up front." And my dad says, "I'll be right back." And he gets in the car and leaves me there, which he used to do a lot of days when he had to go to work. I used to always be there. And Mr. Fong, the manager, used to look out for me. And I used to make sure I was out there practicing. And he comes back with our life savings, with his life savings. And when he shows it to Jim Brown, Mr. Fong is encouraging Jim Brown not to take the bet because he says, "This kid's going to beat you." And
how old were you at the time?
I was 8 years old.
Wow.
Maybe nine, just turned nine. So we go down on the court. He says, "I tell you what, let's play a couple sets and then we'll decide how much to bet." So, you know, I relax, but I kind of, No, I don't dog it a little bit. I just, not much pressure, but I still going to win. And I beat him the first couple sets. And he's getting the feeling like this could be tough. But then he decides to bet me 500 for the third set. He thinks I'm probably pretty tired. I'm 9 years old. He's been running me around. And I end up beating him worse in the third set. And never felt so good. When he shook my hand, man, his hand was huge and rough with calluses.
You know, it's a great story. But on the other hand, you were 8 years old or 9 years old. Your father was putting incredible pressure on you. I mean, as you say, you know, betting his life savings on what you were going to do for him.
Yeah, but you know, if you really think about that through a different lens, you know, it's a real conflicting emotion, because certainly that pressure feels unreasonable for any child. But at the same time, that pride, you know, that confidence, that belief that he had, it was a bit like a drug. It felt good to have a father that believed that much, but then it felt so bad because you just, you almost wish he didn't, but then you're glad he does. And it was a weird emotion for me.
Hmm. Now, you've talked about how you resented how your whole life had turned into tennis. But on the other hand, it was clear from very early on that you were incredibly gifted. And I assume you must have taken pleasure in that skill and enjoyed winning all those tournaments that you did as a junior. Was there a big upside as well?
Well, I think soon you become identified with it, and I think a child winning anything finds some sense of satisfaction. But it was fleeting. You know, that feeling was fleeting. You were always faced with the next challenge. You know, in tennis, you win, and you can win 5 matches and lose one, and you're a loser. You can win 6 matches and lose one, and you're a loser. And you can win a tournament and have to play the next tournament and lose, and you're only as good as your last result. So there was always that never-ending kind of pressure that came along with it that seemed to carry the day at the end.
Now, you talked about then being sent off to a tennis academy, Nick Bollettieri's famous tennis academy. You became his most famous protege. You've described it as like prison camp or maybe boot camp. What was the hardest thing about being there?
Raising yourself, you know, not having any really role models, anybody to really steer, help you make decisions, help you understand things, being so far away from home. All those things were pretty tough. Being in a group of kids where it was like Lord of the Flies with tennis rackets. I mean, we raised ourselves. We determined the rules and the pecking orders, and we determined it any way we saw fit. You know, whether who was going to rebel the most, who won the match, how we did with each other on the tennis court tended to dictate how we dealt with each other off the court, which meant winning was the only way to kind of organize in your life, which came with its own pressures and resentments. And then there was just the fundamental practical life of it. It was a boot camp. It was 4 hours of school and 6 hours of tennis. It was that inverse ratio of tennis to school, you know, left you really having to say no to school because you're just too damn tired to even think about it after a while and even care about it.
You became a tennis prodigy, and then you turned professional really early. I mean, you were 16, and you quickly rose up through the rankings. You were labeled the next great hope of American tennis, which I'm sure must have been a burden. You were flashy. Your hair was long. You wore denim shorts. You hit the ball really hard. And then you did that famous commercial for Canon Camera where you say, "Image is everything." And that, of course, became the rap against you. Did you have any idea what kind of lasting damage that commercial would do to you, to your reputation?
I never thought I'd be 39 years old still talking about it. I'll tell you that much right now. But I quickly started to become aware that you're not going to shake that. I didn't know. But more than not knowing the damage it would do, I didn't know what the actual statement was. It's a weird thing. I was doing a commercial, and a girl that I had known my whole life, who had just come back from college, and she looked so beautiful when I saw her, and she showed up there, and I was thinking more about Wendy than I was thinking about what some guy wants me to say into a camera lens. And when I get done, she even asked me what that was all about, and I said, "I don't know. It's just some line for a camera. It's images everywhere. They're taking images, and it's an image on the screen, and you know, whatever." And certainly I came to regret that. It was a few months later that it became what I was identified with and what haunted me, whether I was doing well on the court or whether I wasn't.
And didn't reporters keep throwing that back at you? I mean, especially when you weren't doing so well, that you were all flash and no substance?
Yeah, reporters, peers, fans, you know, they would yell it from the audience if I was falling apart at the seams. They'd tell me, "That's all right, image is everything." You know, if I was winning, it was like the comments they'd make was always kind of built around this something that I just felt, you know, certainly wasn't what I wanted to be.
Now, you also talk about some of the top players you didn't especially like Boris Becker, who accused you at one point of, he said the Pro Tour was catering to you. He called you elitist, said that the other players didn't really like you. And this got really personal for you, didn't it?
And I didn't know how to deal with that. And one of the ways you can do it is to repress it. But what I chose to do with it that summer when he said those things was turn it into some anger, use anger as a motivator and focus on him. And, you know, there's no secrets between me and Boris as what as we went through, you know. We had beers together late after he was retired, and we had good laughs about it because it's all pretty much juvenile, you know. It's long ago and juvenile in many respects, but it's one of those things that you have to tell because it left an indelible mark on me. What was really formative was how I channeled it and how I used it, and then how I didn't get over the line at the U.S. Open, and all this emotion and all this anger going 26-0 to that U.S. Open final and then losing to Pete, how all of that meant you were a loser. You're 26-1 and you feel like a loser, and that to me was a real meaningless kind of existence.
Hmm. Now, what people always said about Pete Sampras is that he gave his whole life to tennis. He was 100% committed to tennis. And tennis was clearly not your whole life. You had tremendous ups and downs throughout your career. And I guess looking back, I mean, do you have any regrets about not dedicating yourself to tennis the way Sampras did?
No, I don't have regrets about that. I have regrets about a lot of things. You know, I'm glad I found my peace with tennis. That would have been a crime for things to have ended prematurely as it related to me appreciating the game and what it had given me. But winning and adding more titles, you know, I never identified with athletes who did that. It's not something I understood. At times during my career, I wished for his sense of clarity or his sense of focus or his lack of need for inspirations. But for me, it just wasn't in my DNA.
It's the eye of the tiger. It's the cream of the fight.
Andre Agassi is one of the greatest tennis players of all time. His tennis records and accomplishments are many, including 8 Grand Slam championships and a 1996 Olympic gold medal. He retired in 2006. Steve Paulson spoke with Agassi about his memoir, Open.
Rising up straight to the top, have the guts, got the glory.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For more information on competition for sport, visit our website at ttbook.org, where you can also listen to hundreds of other past interviews and stories. If you want to know what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook or Twitter. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with help from Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and our intern, Nayantara Mukherjee. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Thanks to special guest engineer Brittany DeAnda. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.